Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code play100. That's code play100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
Sometimes during Christmas, something magical happens.
Hey, Cricket customers. The Max with Ads plan is included with the Cricket $60 unlimited plan at no additional cost. And this holiday season, Max is the one to watch when you're feeling festive.
Son of a nutcracker!
Cozy up to all the holiday classics like Elf, 8-Bit Christmas, and the Harry Potter 8 film collection. Just log in with your Cricket username and password to experience Max on all your favorite devices. Phone plan streams and standard definition programming subject to change. Fees, terms, and restrictions apply. See cricketwireless.com for details.
Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite football podcast, back for another week. And in some ways, I'm sad to say, in some ways, I'm delighted to say that the age of the preview is over and the age of the season has begun. My name is Jack Collins, and I'll be your host today. And joining me is the Rank God, Mr. Sam Tai. How you doing, mate?
Oh, I'd love to kick it off with a Lord of the Rings reference. Well done.
Yeah, I thought it might go over the heads of some, but I thought it was worth having.
Me. Dean definitely didn't get it.
Yeah. Well, that's it. That's what we're all about here. It's not
alienating, though.
Well, it's not going to be upsetting people who don't get it, but it is going to be a little Easter egg in there for people that do. And okay. Of course, our transfer guru, Mr. Dean Jones. How are you?
I'm toxic, Dean, today, mate. I'm going at people. Get ready for this. I'm going to batter a few people in this podcast.
Toxic Dean returns. It's what the people want.
People like this mask I put on. I'm not going to do it every week, but when it goes on, it goes on. You know,
the world's
what's
most
coming.
Positive
people
football podcast
know what's coming.
And Toxic Dean. It's a match made in heaven in so many ways. Today, we're going to be talking about some players who need to get a move on, literally, who need to be leaving the clubs they are now for their own sakes, the sakes of their career, whatever it is. Sam is going to be preparing a list of those who really, really need to switch clubs before the end of this transfer window. But before we get into all that, it's time for the return of things we love. And Sam, why don't you kick us off?
Yeah, it's a simple one for me, actually. What I love is that Man City have managed to sign two boyhood fans of their club this summer. Now, we're not pretending that these are, you know, youth graduates born and raised in Manchester, or at least one of them was definitely not. Two players that they have signed for a relative amount of money grew up as City fans, and they've managed to dig out pictures of themselves, age 7 or so, wearing Man City shirts. You know, first it was Erling Haaland, and they recreated that picture of him on the couch with the signing video, which was pretty cute. And now Sergio Gomez, who they signed from Anderlecht, who fittingly is a number 10 who plays left back, he was also a City fan growing up as well. And there's a picture of him in a City kit from when he was sort of 7 or 8 as well. It's really sweet. But it's also really weird. And the reason for that is because we're just not used to people from outside of the UK name-checking City as the team they supported as a kid. It's just not something we're necessarily used to. But I guess if you think about it, footballers who are aged 19 or 20, like Sergio Gomez right now, were basically 10 and 11 when Aguero entered the league and transformed Man City. And what has followed is a decade of dominance. Yeah. And as a result of that, City made an impression on these players when they were 10 and 11 or maybe even younger. And they've taken them on as their club. And it's not exactly the same, but I remember thinking when I watched Wissam Ben Yedder go to Monaco a couple of years ago, and he said in his interview, "Oh, I'm delighted. I supported Monaco as a kid." I said, "Did you? No way. Like, what are you what are you on about? There's no way. But then I thought about it. I thought, hang on a minute. When Ben Yedder was 4, 5, 6 years old, Monaco were in the latter stages of the Champions League, semi-finalists often. When Ben Yedder was 14, they made the Champions League final and lost it to Porto. It actually makes pure sense. So look at what success does for a club. Look at what sustained success does for a club. A decade of dominance for City, and they've got players growing up in different countries here who are supporting them as kids. And you know what? It's just nice to see that City have signed two City fans. Okay, yeah. They're still big money deals, but they're still City fans.
Yeah, I like this a lot, and I completely agree with you. I was gonna kind of come on to that point, but you massively handled it yourself, actually. So I'm not gonna go too far into it. But that is it. We are now in an age where growing up as a City fan is kind of just standard, right?
Glory hunters
for people
everywhere
around the world. Well, I mean, look, there's, oh, here he is.
All people are glory hunters.
No, but it's true, isn't it? Like, this is the thing. Man City fans spent years calling people's point of my like glory hunters, because of course you are. Like, as you're a kid, you want to support a good team. Like, it does go hand in hand. And like, Man City obviously didn't have any foreign fans because they weren't very good for a long time. And that's fine. But, you know, it comes around to bite you because they also, you know, Man City fans, like the diehards, they probably don't like how many tourist fans they now have. But it is a reflection of a successful team, isn't it? Like, and that's part of it. You've got to embrace it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, City are also now just a global brand. You know, growing up, for me, City were a team that I used to like City because they always used to fill the away end at Craven Cottage, even in the lower tiers, right? And I remember Fulham coming up right at the start of when I started going to football and whatever, Fulham coming up sort of in kind of tandem with Manchester City. And so there's always been that kind of thing going on. And now you look at it and we're obviously further along the line. And we've seen this a couple of times this summer, right? You saw the pictures of Alexander Zinchenko going to Arsenal and him being like, I was an Arsenal fan growing up. And because of that era, Arsenal was so dominant, right? And that's one of those things that's always just going to kick across. And for people growing up playing football, they're obviously going to be watching, as much as it's great to be, you know, you have Sergio Gomez, and he will almost certainly not have City as the first club he ever supported or the team, you know, he grew up going to see week in, week out. It's not going to be that, but he will be like, there's the team that I supported in the Premier League, or I had a soft spot for at the very, very least. And I think it's cool that we're seeing this new era, and it's also something that people are going to have to get used to. I've seen a lot of it on, you know, on social media. Oh, is he really? Of course he's a City fan. What did he grow up loving? Sean Gota and, you know, Nicky Weaver. Exactly. And obviously, well, it's not that
anymore, is it?
It's not. You know, this is it.
That generation watched Yaya Toure and Aguero and David Silva arrive in the early 2010s and absolutely batter everybody. I'm afraid we're all just really old.
Yes.
that's how it is.
That's the point. But it's, a nice one, Sam. And it is a nice touch to see when people unveil those things. I thought it was a nice touch when Zinchenko did it. I think it's a nice touch today on Sergio Gomez as well. So well done, City. And well done them for digging out those photos, because it does make it. I imagine that, you know, the City fans are... It's a pretty heartwarming thing to see in so many ways. And we've seen some nice things on Twitter from City fans who are just enjoying the idea of these players growing up as City fans alongside them, which is a cool one. Definitely. Right, over to you, Toxic Dean.
Well, I'm going to be quite nice in this part, actually, because the thing I love is that Arsenal fans can actually be proud of their team. They actually have a team they can be proud of and that are showing they might actually be successful. And this is where other teams, Man United fans, I'm mainly talking to you here, need to have long, long vision as to what could be at the end of the road, because you have to be patient through these dark days. And Arsenal fans have definitely had some really dark days. They've been the meme team, Meme United, for years now. Like, basically, before Wenger left, then obviously since Wenger left, like, it's been a long time since Arsenal were actually good and actually heading and seeming to have any direction and I guess a vision for what they wanted to represent as a football club. And actually, like, the way they're playing now, it does actually remind me of times of peak Wenger at times, like the fluidity of the team and the type of football that they play. It is really nice. And more than that, the identities of the players are people that you want to relate to and you want to connect with. And they finally got there. Look, I'm not going to go overboard like some people are and say Arsenal are ready to crack the top three, because we don't need to be there yet. Arsenal need to try and crack the top four. That's where they need to be. And at the moment, they're showing that they're going to. And they've got players that you just love to watch. And the style of their attacking is just brilliant to watch. And I'm just happy for those Arsenal fans, especially all our listeners that are Arsenal fans and have had to put up with some absolute nonsense over the years, whether it was Hector Bellerin being a melon, whether it was Aubameyang doing all sorts of rubbish just because he was fed up with his time there, whether it was some of the genuinely just not very good players and visions and managers that they've had put in place. It's all starting to be put behind them now, and I'm pleased for them because every fan deserves to come out the other end of the tunnel. So I think Arsenal might be there.
Yeah, I like a couple of parallels here. Well, actually, no, one parallel, one juxtaposition. The parallel is AC Milan. Milan were also like the absolute meme club of Italy for about 7 years. Like they're up until 2 years ago, they were absolutely horrific, and some of the players that turned out for them, like Kevin Constant and Jamal Mesbah and those guys, like it's absolutely iconic stuff. Some of those team sheets, the graphics that you get from Milan, they've done a very similar trajectory, and it's amazing how long you spend in the doldrums, even as one of the great institutions of football, and the patience is required. But the juxtaposition I like is obviously this is all happening at the same time as like the first three episodes of this Amazon documentary come out, and you've got this like chasm between where Arsenal are now emotionally, but also like, you know, from a talent perspective, from a harmonious perspective, and basically this time last year, where, you know, fan cams outside the Emirates were just absolutely lapping it up and people shouting about Arteta's got to go. And look, they had a bad start, obviously 3 losses in a row, went to the international break, bottom of the table, hadn't scored a goal. It was awful. It was 1 year ago.
Yeah. Mm. Not even completely. Yeah, this was just the anniversary of the Brentford loss. Never mind the next two.
That's a good way too to understand how when your club's in a crisis, because Arsenal Fan TV obviously took off big time when they were really rubbish, and now Man United fan channels are seeing numbers like they've never seen before. Like, you know, fan rants on Twitter are doing incredible numbers for Man United at the moment. And because all the other teams are absolutely loving it, and even the Man United fans are kind of embracing it because they're like, what else are we going to do? but yeah, did you see the United fans turn on the players at the end of the Brentford game? It was pretty bad. If you haven't seen it, like, I mean, a few people like throwing stuff at them. They were like properly getting at them. Like they want them like out. Like it's got bad, really bad.
It's bad energy, isn't it? Bad energy.
It's really
in the
bad
room.
Energy, but I kind of don't blame them. I mean, I kind of get it, but not sure what you gain by throwing something at them. I know.
It's a strange one, isn't it? Obviously, people lap up other people in the way, I think, especially with United, because for a certain generation, Man United was so dominant, right? And I think it's probably just before me, really. But, you know, the first kind of years, I remember the end of this where United just won title after title after title. There must be, you know, for people sort of, well, I would say of your two ages, where it was just a United period of just, you know, where they just kept going. It was almost relentless. And so I'd imagine that people who had to set that up, and, you know, I've seen City fans do this, but I'd imagine Liverpool fans are exactly the same. You know, they're kind of enjoying this suffering because they're like, this is what it was like for me. And especially, you know, I've seen Stephen McInerney write about this the other day and saying, as a kid, you know, being a City fan in Manchester at school, it was like, you know, every day was like, they're well good, aren't they? Like, you know, this is it. Unfortunately, I've just got to deal with this. And so now that United are, you know, on the other end of this wheel, if you will, they're at the bottom of the wheel as it goes round.
Literally.
People are loving it. And that's kind of how it is. But I think your point about it going out the other side of the tunnel is right. At some point, these things do come to an end.
They do come around. Football, as we've talked about many times before, like it comes in cycles, and you've got to enjoy your times at the top because you will have your time at some point at the bottom. So that's part of being a fan, and it's all part of the journey. If you were just winning constantly, and if United was still winning titles every year since Fergie left, it would be so boring by now. Like, but once they do get back, I don't know, maybe they will never win another Premier League, but like it's going to obviously still be a way off. But like one day Man United probably will win the Premier League again, even if it's in like 7 years' time, 8 years' time.
It could be further. But it
could be further,
that's
but whenever
it
happens, that moment is going to be worth the wait and probably better than 10 of the ones that they've actually had in not so distant memory.
Yeah, I know Liverpool fans felt like that, you know, a couple of years back. Obviously, it was a little bit different in that they couldn't be in the stadium. But that
that
release of energy and the release of all that build up over the years of hurt, if you will, is such an amazing thing. But yeah, no, I like that. Very, very good. Two nice things there, lads. So very, very good. I'm going to finish us off in Italy. I just want to talk about what was an absolutely mad first weekend in Serie A. Zero draws, 10 games, 10 wins, 10 losses, obviously.
That's a dream for an ACCA. You never put draws on ACCAs, really, do you?
Never put draws on ACCA. That's the one. And actually, Italy was a beautiful one for an ACCA this week because, to be perfectly honest with you, pretty much all the favourites won. So if you had just backed the favourites in Italy, you probably would have come out on the top this weekend. 34 goals, an average of 3.4 a game, obviously. Late winner for Inter, where Lukaku scored in his return. They really left it late. Denzel Dumfries turning up as a striker, as Sam would love, bundling one home in the 96th minute to beat newly promoted Lecce, who were excellent. Very, very impressive. Napoli won 5-2 against Hellas Verona. They had five different goal scorers, including a debut goal and an assist for Quincy Kvaratskhelia. So that was very, very impressive. A lovely debut from him. Victor Osimhen scored. He's off the mark. Zielinski scored a lovely goal. Politano scored one. And Stanislav Lobotka, who stepped into the side in the absence of Fabian Ruiz, just like marauded through midfield and started a beautiful goal home at one point. Juve had Di Maria and Vlahovic linking up nicely. Now, Di Maria got injured as the only downside yesterday. But Juve weren't brilliant, but 1-3-0, and that's kind of okay because the hallmark of Allegri's Juve was not playing that well.
I mean, I have to admit, when it was 0-0, the first goal was quite important in that game, wasn't it? Yeah, like I thought I had that 2-1 prediction on Patreon. I was like, you know what, I needed that as a joke, but actually this could happen.
Yeah, no, absolutely, 100%. There were two red cards in Lazio-Bologna, including an absolutely nutty one for Sam's old friend Luis Maximiano, did exactly what Hradecky did the other week, but worse, because he wasn't waiting for the ball. He went out to claim it, just dived outside the box, sent off 6 minutes into his debut.
Melanish stuff.
Not ideal. Yeah, Melanish stuff. There was a lot of contenders this week, though, so we'll get on to that one. There was another one at Fiorentina, another Melan contender in Yonat Radu, who dropped a 96-minute cross from Manchukuo over the line, meant that Fiorentina won. But there was also an Olympic goal, which is something you don't see all that often. A goal direct from a corner for Cremonese. Fiorentina very nearly did a Fiorentina. And despite being 2-1 up against a newly promoted side at home and with their opposition having 10 men, conceded an equaliser. And it took some absolute dramatics at the end to stop Fiorentina drawing their first game, which would have been a travesty. But alas, this is the kind of nature of the club. What was it that Chiellini said? This is the history of the Fiorentina. this is very much the history of Fiorentina. So thankfully it got over the line, but it did look a little bit sketchy for a long period at the Franchi. There was the woodwork hit four times in the game between Atalanta and Sampdoria. Atalanta won 2-0, but Samp hit the woodwork three times, including a lovely chip from Quagliarella, who came off the bench. And with Ciccio Caputo, might form the oldest strike partnership of all time. That's a 39-year-old and a 35-year-old up top for Sampdoria at times. That's a long one. We've got Rome, the first instance of Roma's trident, Zaniolo, Abraham and Dybala. So what we're saying is ZAD, I think I'm going to call them the Dazzler.
Okay.
I think that's a nice name for the trident. Now, it wasn't all fun and
games.
The
Zad Army.
I'm not sure about that. But they weren't perfect, as Sam and I discussed in a little bit more depth on Monday's post box. But there was plenty of signs of life, I thought, from the three of them. So that was exciting. And of course, Champions Milan fought back twice from a goal down to win 4-2 in a very good second half performance from Milan. So yeah, lots of fun in Serie A.
There was. Do you know what? Just go back. I don't actually often bet. I don't normally do ACCAs, but I did do one this weekend just to liven up my weekend, basically, because the kids were ill and I needed some escapism. Anyway, so I picked seven games. This really annoyed me. Villa to win, done. Arsenal to win, done. Brighton Newcastle draw, done.
You put a draw in your ACCA.
I did. Nice. Brighton Newcastle, it just seems so obvious, that one.
But it does wonders for the odds, doesn't it?
It does, and that's the thing. You've got to throw one in there. Man City Bournemouth, done. AC Milan Udinese, done. Lecce versus Inter, just about done. The last one, lads. Leipzig Cologne.
Leipzig, Soboslai sent off in the first half, but Leipzig was still winning. They still were getting the job done, and they let in a late equaliser. It was two.
It was an own goal, wasn't it?
Guardiola as well. Like, oh my God.
Killer, mate. That is brutal.
On the floor.
I'm sorry for you,
would
mate.
Have won about £200. It would have really perked up a rubbish day, as it was. So cheers,
man. Imagine.
Cheers, Guardiola. Well, cheers, Soboslai.
We talked about Lukaku scoring on his return to Inter. Timo Werner scored on his return to Leipzig as well. A good weekend for Chelsea or ex-Chelsea boys returning to their former clubs is how I would put it. But there we have it. There are our things we love this week. We will be back, of course, after the break to talk about players who really need that move. Don't go anywhere.
Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code play100. That's code play100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
Welcome back to Ranks FC, where it is time for our main ranking. Sam, over to you.
Yeah, it's players who really need to move clubs. We do this every year. We take a look at the situation about 2 weeks out from the end of the window. You know what? For about 3 years, this was basically just like Gareth Bale and Isco territory. But times have changed and these guys have moved on. So it's time for some others to step forward.
This is a staple. I like it. I like a rank staple.
I do. Do you mind if I start with a few caveats as usual?
I don't mind at all, mate. Off you go.
Yeah, so I'm not going to speak about anybody that we already covered a couple of weeks ago when we talked about the best players available, because there's no need to really tread on that ground again. So Kelly Navas, you know, Florian Grillich, Frenkie de Jong, those guys, we're not going to cover them today, but obviously there's a conversation there. On the subject of Frenkie, I'm also not really interested in joining the chorus of boos towards Barcelona's bomb squad. All of those players the club are currently trying to shoo away with a big stick. I am not going to add fuel to the fire. I'm also not going to talk about Diego Demi, just for your benefit, really. You know, obviously, we all know he needs to leave Napoli, but why go over that?
Considering Lobotka got the nod over him in the first game, you're like, oh, I saw the pain etched on Sam's face as I delivered that news.
He's got to go. Anyway, 2 weeks left of the window, and the five guys we're about to talk about very, very badly need a move. And I've kind of picked them out across Europe because I think their careers have come to a standstill. Obviously, there's lots of players that could benefit from a move upwards or downwards, but these guys, I think, really need to actually start kicking on again. And I think they've actually reached a genuine standstill. So that's why I have picked them. And I'm going to start at number five with Adama Traoré of Wolves, who nearly joined Spurs in January, should have joined Spurs in January, by all accounts. Instead, got loaned to Barcelona. He's come back. He's played 12 minutes as a substitute across the first two games. Mm. Wolves have just signed a fast, direct wide forward in Gonzalo Guedes to add to their other fast, direct wide forward, Hwang Hee-chan. Wolves appear to have mentally moved on from Adama, but it's possible they've forgotten he's still contracted to the club, so they haven't actually contractually moved on from him. He's still an employee. At 26, he's come to a standstill, and he clearly, very clearly needs a move, and everyone seems to be in agreement. It just hasn't happened yet.
Not sure what's going on with him. He's not even playing, is he? Like, it's like...
He came on for the last couple of minutes against Fulham. Anthony Robinson bottled him up, so that was fine.
What is that about? Again, they're drawing 0-0 and Adama Traoré gets a few minutes. Like, that is nonsense, isn't it? One to look out for, Chelsea. Always had him in the background for as interest. And at the moment, you know, obviously going after Anthony Gordon, that's the high-profile one that's being talked about right now. But I think it's worth realising that Chelsea still want two forwards to come into their attack. Anthony Gordon is also quite versatile, so like he's not going to play like the position we saw him play last weekend for Everton. Like, he's going to be a midfielder slash attacker. And he's so young that he's still progressing and learning. So we've seen them going after like Chukwuemeka, Slonina. There's that other guy, Kayseide, I think his name is, at Inter.
Kayseide.
Is it? Yeah, so like, there's that style of player that they're signing right now, but they're also trying to sign, well, they've got Koulibaly, Sterling, and they want another forward who's got that Premier League experience we've talked about before, like obviously Aubameyang or Vardy or Zaha, like Ronaldo, probably not, but you never know. But I imagine like Adama could come into that idea. Like he's a Premier League experienced attacker who would add some threat to that attack. They're just lacking something, aren't they, at the moment, Chelsea? And it wouldn't surprise me if they were to add Traore. He's so adaptable to the formations that Chelsea are using at the moment. They could use him in about three different positions. Wouldn't surprise me if we saw him go there. The Tottenham one seems to be dead. Very weird how you can go from Wolves to almost to Tottenham to Barcelona to back to Wolves, but not even in the Wolves team. And you're 2 weeks away from the deadline and you're still just sat there. Something's got to happen.
Yeah, it's a really weird move, this. But I also don't like Chelsea after him at all, because Chelsea have a lot of profiles in this attack, right, who are good at certain things. They're good at pressing and you know, they're a good creation attempts, but they can't put the ball in the back of the net. This is what we've seen of the last thing. Now, Sterling was brought in to try and rectify this problem, which makes sense. But as we saw at the weekend, he was trying to set up chances for himself at a certain point. He needs some help. Now, Adama Traore is at best a streaky finisher, but I would say perfectly not a very good one. And Anthony Gordon isn't a brilliant finisher either. He's also good at the things that Chelsea already have in abundance, pressing, creation. You know, and I think that Chelsea are targeting players who are kind of just the same as the ones they've got. And I find that very, very strange, considering what we've seen from Chelsea over the first two games, where their goals have been scored by, one, a penalty, and then two, from defence. You know, once from a set piece and once from Reece James breaking out a wing back. That's a worry, I think. That doesn't feel like Chelsea are targeting the right profile of players. Although, you know, that said, Tuchel has famously been better when he's gone strikerless. So maybe, what do I know?
Maybe. I mean, look, the rise of like wing back systems and three at the backs across Europe, it might just be the ticket that gets Adama a nice little move somewhere. It doesn't have to be Chelsea. It could be somewhere else. I think he'd be fantastic in Serie A. And the other question mark here is, like, obviously Denzel Dumfries keeps getting linked to Chelsea. Now, he would definitely score goals because he thinks he's a striker, but he's not really the profile of wing back that I think Tuchel would enjoy, because I don't see either of Adama or Dumfries as really neat technical players, really good in tight spots and good at controlling the rhythm of a game. I don't see them as that player. So I don't really see them as perfect for Tuchel. But, you know, if they did end up pulling the trigger on Dumfries, then Inter should go straight to Adama Traore. You know, that's the sort of thing that could open up. I don't know what happens here. He feels like a break glass in case of emergency on August 30 for someone, like somewhere who needs something.
I like that a lot. Definitely.
Yeah.
Probably go back to Barcelona or something.
I mean, everyone else seems
right
to
back.
Be, that's it. Yeah, they need a right back. They do need a right back.
Get Dest to Wolves.
We shall see. We shall see. All right, Sam, who's in the next?
Right, number four is going to be Marco Asensio, who doesn't really feel like he's in the picture at Real Madrid anymore. He actually played more than you'd expect last season, but I think that was more to do with the quantity of games Madrid were involved in. And even then, when you consider the total minutes they had to play, he was still a bit part figure. He's very, very talented, Marco Asensio, and he's done very well to return from a serious injury. And I will always respect players that have managed to do that. But his big problem is a lack of consistency. And he just does not hit the high notes anywhere near as often as a Real Madrid attacker needs to hit them. And that ultimately creates a glass ceiling above his head, which means he cannot imprint on this team. And look, he's been around for ages. He's won so much silverware. They seem to be not that committed to him, and he doesn't seem committed to them either. Like, there's a year left on his deal and they're doing a weird, like, kind of standoffish thing this summer where they're like waiting for each other to kind of commit to another, and it's not really happening. And I kind of feel like this is a chance for Marco Asensio here to move on and to become more of a key figure now at age 26 or so somewhere else. The rise of Rodrigo has not helped him. Fede Valverde turning into a workhorse right wing has not helped him. And there doesn't really seem to be a big role for him any longer. And hanging on, he'll play another 700 minutes. not do much and leave for free next summer. Just cut the cord, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think this is fair. I guess the question then becomes, what level does Marco Asensio go to? Because if he's not consistent enough for Real Madrid, he's probably not consistent enough for any side who want to challenge at the sharp end of the Champions League, you would imagine. Now, there were links to Liverpool earlier in the summer. That doesn't feel right to me. Not only would he be competing with a spot with Mohamed Salah, which is never a particularly good idea for anyone, I'd imagine, at this point, but also he just doesn't feel like a massively Kloppy type player. So, yeah, he's not a clip Kloppy. So, unfortunately, I think that, are we looking here at a team that maybe is looking at the sharp end of the Europa League for someone that would really take in an Asensio? It might be someone who just takes a gamble, who needs a little bit of magic, a sprinkle of magic dust and a big name coming in towards the end of this window.
I was thinking more like AC Milan or something, like, you know, that sort of thing. Like, it's a step down, but it's not that much of a step down. I don't think we're talking about a Europa League team. I think he's still Champions League quality.
No, I know, but would he rather go and win things? I know that doesn't apply to Milan, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but I don't think he has to take too far a step down. It's just, you know, not to criticise Asensio too much there, but the bar to be a Real Madrid attacker is just like, it's in the sky, you know? Yeah. You've got to match up to Benzema and Vinicius. Just absolutely outrageous. He's just not quite there, but he could play for a lot of other clubs. And you know what? If you got that run of games and felt more valued and felt like he was being put into the team and given a run, maybe he would become more consistent. How easy is it to step into the team every 4 weeks or off the bench every other week? And you know, when he gets on, all he does is take shots. But it's probably because he wants to score and like prove himself. So I wonder what the snowball effect there would be of taking one step back.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I didn't mean that in a particularly negative sense. You know, you look at the names in the hat here in the Europa League this season. You're talking Roma, Manchester United, Arsenal, Lazio, Braga, Real Sociedad, Real Betis, Monaco. Like, these are big sides, you know.
You're not talking Rapid Vienna. It's fine.
I'm not talking. Yes, no. I mean, top end of the Europa League. Thank you very much. But I don't see quite. If he'd gone to Roma before they'd signed Dybala, I would have been like, that's quite interesting. If he'd signed for an Arsenal before they'd done their business this summer, I would have found that quite interesting. I don't know where he goes in these spots now. You know, Real Sociedad feel like they don't really play with that type of player unless he was playing in a front two. Betis play with wingers, but I mean, I don't think Betis can sign anyone. It's been an absolute shambles to try and get the squad registered. So I'm not sure if any of those are actual options at this point, but it does feel like this is the kind of caliber of club I'd be looking at.
Yeah, I agree. Tough one, but there will be something out there for him if he wants it, but we don't really know where he stands with the club at the moment. So it is another wait and see.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Who's at three then?
Right. This is probably the most contentious one. It's Mohamed Kudus at Ajax. I know we've barely got started into this season. I'm not trying to draw conclusions off very small sample sizes, but I think if Kudus was an important player to the new Ajax coach Alfred Schreuder, I feel like we'd already know it, because he's an outrageous preseason, and I wonder if maybe that could have tipped it and could have given him a little initial run in the team. But he's played even fewer minutes than Adama Traore. He's got 7 minutes across the first two games, and like, I know there are going to be minutes for him. I know the schedule will hot up and Ajax will need him at certain points. And this is why it's the contentious one, because I think of all the five players we're going to talk about today, Kudus is the one that, of all the clubs involved, probably can afford to lose him the least, because they will need him as a sort of fifth centre midfielder and maybe a third striker. But that's not a good position to be in if you're the player. It's an ideal player to have if you're the club, but it's bad for Kudus. And he's basically got no better in 2 years. Since he's joined Ajax, he's kind of gone nowhere. And it's sad. It's sad that he hasn't been able to get any rhythm, hasn't been able to get a run of games, and hasn't been able to improve at Ajax at any point. And if I were him, I'd be a little bit sick of that, and I'd want to get going. I want a loan, basically. I'd want to get going. But I don't think Ajax are going to be able to stomach the loss here. But the sick reality is that Kudus could walk into Man United's team tomorrow and massively improve the press resistance and the ball progression, and he could do it for a number of other top teams too.
Yeah, is he one of these players who is kind of harmed by their versatility in so many ways. This is my thoughts on him, because he can do so many roles. You know, we saw him as a nine in preseason at times. I don't think that's his best role, but we saw him do some very nice things there. We saw him in center midfield. We've seen him wide before. That ability to be that kind of Swiss Army knife for any manager, and if there's injuries in any position, means that you're a bit indispensable, but you're also kind of dispensable in the day-to-day, if that makes sense.
And also Ajax, you know, I'm absolutely not going to begrudge them for trying to prioritize academy talent. And, you know, this season they've tried to bring Kenneth Taylor in through the academy and into the first team, and he's played the first two games, and Taylor's been brilliant, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, again, not going to criticize Ajax for prioritizing homegrown players. It just leaves a player like Kudus in a really funny situation. And I don't know if he would be able to get a loan, but he could get a loan somewhere and play Champions League football and really improve some teams. He could also leave, but I consider Ajax silly for selling him. But that's why I feel like it's the contentious one. I sort of couldn't wrap my head around it too well, because there's so many good scenarios for Kudus to step into, but I don't know if Ajax can really sanction it.
Yeah. Tottenham had an eye on him. Tottenham were linked, and I think that their overall view is like, let's just see this one out. Let's see what actually happens with him. Like, we don't necessarily need him right now. So I think they might revisit that if he's still not playing in the new year, because I think there's probably value to be having in taking him on. But not sure Tottenham really need him. Like you said, there's probably clubs out there right now that need him more than Tottenham. And he probably, if he's going to leave, he's going to want some games, isn't he?
Yeah, but there are also like loads of clubs out there who could use him and probably won't look at him, won't consider him. I don't know why, but it just kind of feels like the player that flies under the radar a little bit. And then someone really smart like Crystal Palace somehow ends up buying him or something like that. And it's like, how the hell did they? It's another one of those, you know? Yeah. I can absolutely see that happening in like a year's time. He just signs for Palace because everyone misses out on him and he doesn't quite crack the year at Ajax again. And look, it's not a disrespect to Crystal Palace, but if you spend 3 years at Ajax, don't progress and end up at Palace, that's not how you wanted it to go. Mm-hmm. And you're setting yourself back. So it's a tough one for him. But I just love to see him go and play football. He brings me a lot of joy when he plays.
Yeah, I mean, you've basically just told me that he's Jairo Riedewald, which is a bit of an uncomfortable place to be. And I don't think that's fair on the poor lad. I don't think that's fair on him at all. I feel like that is not okay. But Ami Kudus is a hell of a footballer.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting to see how that one develops. So yeah, that's a very good show. I don't think that's controversial. You said this is the one that would probably cause the most conversation. Maybe it's a conversational one. But I think you'll find Ajax fans who will be like, we really like him, but I just can't see where he fits in at this point. And if you're him, you need to progress. This is you're getting up to some very critical points in your career.
Yeah, I think he's 22 now and he's been sort of stood still for 2 years. But if you ask Alfred Schroeder, he'll say he's a key part of his plans because, you know, again, fixtures come thick and fast in October and he'll get some minutes. He'll just be always in and out, never gaining rhythm. And it's tough. It's really tough from that perspective.
Okie dokie. Right then, let's go to number two.
Right, number two is Manuel Akanji of Dortmund. Yes, he's still at Dortmund.
Yes, he is, yeah.
So in the same way that Wolves have mentally moved on from Adama Traore, Dortmund have clearly mentally moved on from Akanji. Yeah. They bought two new centre-backs to arrive this summer in Schlotterbeck and Süle. And they still got Mats Hummels. And while Akanji has appeared, I think, hasn't even been on the bench recently. They've got Soumaila Koulibaly on the bench instead of him. So Akanji is, I think, on paper, fourth choice. But obviously, while they're possibly trying to get rid of him, he's fifth choice. But he's not even in the matchday squad at this point. I presume it's because he sat in the departure lounge with a suitcase, waiting and waiting and waiting. I don't really know how good he is anymore. Find him very hard to gauge. Yeah. So I don't really know who to suggest that he goes to. What I would say is that there are some centre-backs who seem to defy all logic, and Akanji is one of them. He's every tool in the box to be a top centre-back because he has great abilities, good on the ball, great physical attributes. But I think he just makes too many mistakes and he hasn't quite grown out of it as he's got older. And it's similar to the complex we had on Andreas Christensen about 3 years ago, where he seemed to have every tool in the box, but he just lacked confidence and wasn't physical and wasn't aggressive and therefore wasn't the player that, you know, on paper he should be. And Akanji feels like that player. Dortmund clearly have reached the stage where they're not interested in giving him any more chances, not willing to go with him any longer. They've moved on from him. They've bought a whole new central defensive pairing to play. But Akanji's still at the club.
Yeah, it's a strange one. I do wonder if in that situation, is he a player that could thrive with a switch to being as part of a back three, and allowing those weaknesses to be kind of transferred a little bit or covered a little bit more by players. You know, there are rumors that Inter are after him, and I don't think that's too bad a shout from where I'm standing. You move him into a defensive line that has so many, you know, brilliant defenders already in it, and allow him to utilize his skill set and his toolbox in the best possible way, whilst not being quite as stressed about a mistake leading to click out opportunities for opposition, and therefore in itself kind of eradicating those mistakes, but as he progresses in confidence.
Maybe. I don't know anymore. I literally have no idea, because if he goes to Inter, he's not going to be starting, is he?
No.
So, you know, I'm not saying that Akanji needs to move because he needs to play first team football. I'm saying he needs to move because his club have literally forgotten about him. So, yeah, it kind of makes sense that you could just go anywhere, a new fresh start or whatever. But I don't know what Akanji wants from that. I don't know if he wants to play first team football. He just wants a fresh start.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Is there any kind of other interesting?
None more that I've heard of, especially, I mean, obviously mainly my focus is in England, and it doesn't seem to be anyone here that's been knocking on the door. But yeah, it is a strange one that he's still there. I mean, it's weird. Someone will pick yes. him up.
Like, well, yeah, someone will pick him up, and someone you'd imagine will pick up Dan Axel Zagadou, who's just rolling around as a free agent at 23 years old, which just seems absolutely nuts, frankly. But here we are, and yeah. I know you're not including free agents in this one, Sam, but yeah. it does feel like those two who were pretty much, and I know, you know, Dortmund weren't completely and utterly brilliant at the back last year. They weren't, you know, there was plenty of things to dislike, but equally, you know, they were the starting center backs for a team that finished in the top four in Germany. You'd imagine that someone would take a punt on at least one of them.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Zagadou's probably got injury red flags and all sorts of stuff like that. But Akanji, I don't think, has a particularly bad injury record, unless I'm mistaken. It's the mistakes, so yeah, we'll have to see.
Indeed. Okay, which takes us on to your number one, which I'm intrigued to find out.
Number one is Callum Hudson-Odoi.
Good one. Good one.
I mean, yeah, Chelsea just don't seem to have very much faith in him, sadly. Again, he's returned from a serious injury. A lot of respect for that. He's had a really, really tough 18 months. I felt quite positive about his stock coming into the summer. I don't know about you guys, but we've got some good preseason reports, you know, trusting his body again. He's got the acceleration back, you know, working back from an Achilles injury. The initial injuries fixed. The secondary injuries you pick up off the back of that, they'd all settled down. But he just doesn't really seem to be part of this team. And I do really feel like Tuchel has a very clear idea of what he wants to roll with this season in terms of what his 11 is, and then who his plan A, B, or plan B, C, and D is. Like, he's got his game breaker in Armand Broja. Pulisic seems to be the next in line. They're still in the market for forwards, as we've discussed. They've already signed Sterling and they want more. I'd say that if Hudson-Odoi is, you know, if he's looking at the bottom of his teacup this morning, the leaves will read, you've got to get out of here. And he should, because he's a really good player. He's still really, really young, right? He's 21.
Mm-hmm.
He's 21. And he needs to go and play some football. And I know there's been conversations, Dean, so I'm hoping you tell me something's a bit further on, but he's still there. He's still on the bench at the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, he's still there, but he won't be by the time this window's done. I think Chelsea are open to him leaving. He's got a big decision to make, because he knows he's got so many clubs have inquired about him, not just in this window, but in the last two that came before it, to be honest with you, because there just hasn't been much scope for him to play with every addition that's been made to that front line. He's got to obviously think carefully about the offers that are on the table. Does he stay in the Premier League? Does he go and try himself outside of the Premier League? There are clubs in Europe. The most interesting to me is Dortmund, who we spoke about a minute ago. But like, I would love to see Callum Hudson-Odoi go to Dortmund. I think that is the perfect place for him to go. Bayer Leverkusen have been linked too. Like, if he wanted to go and challenge himself in Bundesliga, I think that's a great fit. Just for the style of football they play and the ambition that they've got for this season, particularly, and the fact he'll really be able to get at people and raise his own confidence. I think that's going to be key for Hudson-Odoi, whatever comes next. Let's get the confidence going again. Ultimately, like, Chelsea will have the option of including him as a make-way in whatever big deals they do. So, you know, if Anthony Gordon, obviously the talks are ongoing about how they could potentially get that over the line. if you were to say Frank Lampard, can we include Hudson-Odoi in this deal in some way? He's going to be open to it, isn't he? I mean, Frank Lampard would take pretty much any attacker in Europe right now, so he's certainly going to take somebody he knows like Hudson-Odoi. But then there are other clubs like Leicester, Southampton, Crystal Palace, Newcastle. There's loads in half the Premier League wants Callum Hudson-Odoi because he's great. He's a really good player. He just isn't fitting in with how Tuchel's built this squad. And that's not really a slant on his playing style or the type of character he is, I don't think. It's just bad luck. This is the way that Tuchel's built this team and you don't quite fit in. That's okay.
And he's had a tough 18 months of injury.
He's really
far behind in preparation and readiness, so it's just tough to come back from.
It'll be interesting to see whether he takes a permanent or a loan. That's what I will be most interested in here, because I say I do expect him to go. It'd be a bold move to go permanently, but sometimes those are the ones that really, really define you and actually give you the best chance of cracking it. Because if you do the loan thing, you're always tempted to go back and try again. Take Jesse Lingard, for example. I know he was older when he did it, but that loan spell at West Ham convinced him that he could still crack it at Man United, and then he wasted another year by sitting on the bench at Man United. And I don't want Hudson-Odoi to do that. Like, if he moves and cracks it for a year, I want him to stay away from Chelsea and crack it. They'll put a buyback in wherever he goes anyways. He could always come back one day like most Chelsea players do, and he could do that.
That's famously goes well, that.
Yeah, so maybe you shouldn't do that. But I think it's good that this is number one, because I think this is one of actually the most fascinating storylines that we'll see open up in the next 2 weeks.
It seems like a long time ago that Bayern offered, you know, a loan with a 70 million euro option on it. Or I think the final bid that they put in that window was just a straight 30 million-ish bid for Callum Hudson-Odoi. Well, and, you know, it wasn't long after that he got injured. Mm. Will that go down as one of the big missed opportunities to actually make money on a player that ever was, actually, in terms of where he was at that point and the regard he was held in that then wasn't kind of tricked in? Because that was similar-ish times to the first time that Bayern went after Leroy Sané, wasn't it? And obviously it's been very interesting to see that kind of develop and the way that their careers have maybe a little bit diverged since that point. So, yeah, I am really intrigued by this one as well. And I'm with Dean. I'd really like him to maybe go abroad for a little while. But if that, you know, if those rumours for a Chelsea bid for Will Zaha are true, I think Hudson-Odoi would thrive at Palace under Vieira. I like that a lot. I think that would be, you know, that would be a very sensible manoeuvre from Crystal Palace as well, right? Obviously, they'd be loath to lose Wilf because he is and has consistently been one of the best players outside the top six for a long time in the Premier League. But he's got a year left on his contract. You're trading him in for a far younger player who's also explosive and exciting. And I think that would end up being pretty smart business if I was Palace. That's what I'd be asking for as part of that deal is Callum Hudson-Odoi on a permanent deal going the other way. So it'd be very interesting. Just on this, though, and, you know, Dean, you said at the top of the episode that Chelsea are looking at bringing in two more attackers. You know, one of them is clearly Anthony Gordon. They're looking elsewhere as well. If two more come in, does Christian Pulisic need to get out of Chelsea? Because, he's already clearly down with the pecking order here. Yes, he's come on as a sub in the last two games, but this is a player who was brought in to, you know, to be a game changer. And he is clearly not a first team pick at the moment for Thomas Tuchel. And you'd imagine if two more come through the door, his place in that pecking order is going to slide down even further.
Yeah, but the thing is, there's people at Chelsea that want Pulisic to stay. I mean, they've got an American owner now, and that affects things. Toboli wants Pulisic to have a future there. Chelsea are trying to urge him to stay patient and saying he will get opportunities. Pulisic, obviously, the World Cup year, this isn't ideal. He would like the opportunity to go elsewhere if an offer actually came. I mean, Newcastle have shown some interest. Like, potentially, we could
send him down the road to the cottage. He'll be all right.
That would be fun.
He could team up with Anthony Robinson, Tim Ream and the boys. We'll have a nice time.
I'm not against it. There's not many Chelsea players that I'd want at Fulham, but I'll take Pulisic. But yeah, I mean, and also, like, you know, Werner's gone. Hudson-Odoi will be going. Hakim Ziyech will be going. Like, they're the three that Chelsea are open to actually go in at the moment ahead of him. So yeah, at the moment, Pulisic would be open to a move, but it probably won't happen for him.
Hmm. Okay, an interesting one. Lots to happen at the bridge, you'd imagine, between here and the end of the window. It's Todbo season. it's all very exciting.
Him and his big loud t-shirt negotiating transfers.
Yes, exactly. No doubt about it. It's going to be interesting. Well done, Sam. Very, very good. Excellent shouts. Any honourable mentions, or are we going
to
leave it
there? Yeah, I'm about 200. I tried to slim it down as much as I could, and I tried to pick something from most leagues, which I think I largely achieved. And I tried to go multi-position as well.
Very good. Very good. Well done. A very, very good ranking. Right. After the break, we are going to see Toxic Dean give his Melon of the Week. And of course, there's the gibberish rankings. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Ranks FC, where it's time for everybody's favourite part of the week, hosted by everyone's favourite toxic host. Toxic Dean, over to you.
It's time for Melon of the Week. This week's Melon of the Week is Darwin Núñez. He's back. He's only been in English football for about 6 weeks, and he's already got Melon of the Week twice. The first time, a lot of people didn't agree with it. This time, I've had DMs already saying, it's Darwin, isn't it? With a lot of melon emojis. It's Darwin, isn't it? Of course it's Darwin. Don't get me wrong. There were a lot of goalkeepers that could have won this award. And I was going to do a ranking, basically, of all the mistakes that goalkeepers had made over the weekend, because there was four or five. But here we were on Monday night watching Darwin Núñez on his home debut at Anfield for Liverpool. I mean, it wasn't going well in the first place. I mean, I thought his performance was poor generally. I thought that Joachim Andersen had him in his pocket. I thought the little tactics, it was nothing. What he was doing to him was run-of-the-mill stuff that you do as an experienced Premier League defender. There's a great highlights reel on Twitter going around that a few people sent me of the kind of, I want to say duel. It wasn't even a duel.
It was all of their interactions, wasn't it?
All of their interactions, and just how annoyed Darwin came throughout the game. But this is just the stuff that he's going to have to deal with on a weekly basis, and more so now because people have seen how rattled he was.
Look, yeah, I think Joachim Andersen is actually quite polite in the pantheon.
That's the thing. He's one of the nicest blokes in the Premier League. So Darwin's got big problems coming up when he comes against some of the others. First chance he gets, there was that one that he stuck over the bar. Okay, he might have seen that one late. Still thought it was a poor finish, should have scored. There was that other one that hit the post, should have scored that. I mean, once that one hit the post, I was like, here we go, here we go. There was another one which looked like a sitter. Was it Salah that set him up?
The defender got a nick on that one that hit the post, didn't it? I think maybe, or was there a slight touch or pressure, but it was,
He still should have put it away, but he's a little bit unlucky.
He should have scored, and then there was another chance, and he missed that. So things were not looking well for our friend. And then he headbutts Joachim Andersen. He becomes the first player of the Jurgen Klopp era to be sent off for violent conduct. He's the first Liverpool player to be sent off on his Anfield debut since Joe Cole in 2010. He's the first Liverpool player to win Melon of the Week twice in a season, I think.
Yeah.
This is not good. And I mean, like, look, he's suspended now for 3 matches. He's going to miss games. Obviously, it's a big one at the weekend against Man United that he's going to miss. And to be honest, the 3 games he's going to miss, Man United and Bournemouth, big chances to kind of not only become part of this team, but also like growing confidence because his opportunity is going to be there to score goals.
And to become
goals.
A cult hero against Man United.
And to become a hero, and then they've got Newcastle too, will be the third one. So Firmino will now come back in against United. I just think on the back of a poor pre-season, because it was a poor pre-season, and he's not anything like the rest of this team. He's not on the same wavelength as a footballer. There was one cross he put in last night, the one that he drilled just straight into the goalkeeper's arms. You can't do that at Liverpool. Everyone just looked at him like, what are you doing? Like, we weren't there. And I understand, like, there's not many players, Luis Diaz might disagree, that can just walk into Liverpool's lineup and settle in.
Yeah, what a goal.
What's a goal, and what a player he's been since.
As once, I think I saw it on Twitter, someone said, as one South American tried to dig Liverpool further into the dirt, another one picked up his shovel and dug them back out of it. And it was true.
And like, this is another thing that's not going to help Darwin, is that Luis Diaz went in there so seamlessly as a signing that changed them. But now, he's not just coming in as a signing that's got to settle in. He's seen as the replacement. I know they're not the same, but he's replacing Mane in that squad. And Mane
was a serious figure in that squad. Liverpool now off to a start of two games and no wins. It's not good. They're already off the pace and there aren't going to be that many opportunities throughout the course of the season to claw that back because Man City will not drop that many points. Obviously, like at the moment, I'm not saying they're out the title race just yet, but it's not a good start. Like you looked at that start of the season and Liverpool should have 6 points on the board from playing Fulham and Crystal Palace from their first two games.
Everyone would have expected Liverpool to be 6 points up at this point, right? Have six on the board. The fact that they're 4 points behind that already is not like a nail in the coffin by any stretch of the imagination, but it's equally not good. I agree.
It's a nail through the hand. It hurts.
It will hurt. And it will hurt that it was at Anfield. And James Milner said this in his post-match interviews. You know, it was like, it hurts more because we were here and here we expect to win every week. He's like, there's one thing going on the road and being a different atmospheres and whatever, but at Anfield, you know, no matter who the opposition is, Liverpool expects to win against pretty much everyone, you know, City almost included in this. And you think you're looking at that and going, right, so you're already kind of dropping at hurdles that you don't hugely have. I don't think it's over equally. I think City will drop more than 4 points this season, but that revolves a lot of things going right now for Liverpool. And they've put themselves in a position where they're starting from, you know, 4 points behind without really getting going at all. I'm not going to do it. There's no defense for Darwin doing what he did at all. It's madness. And not only did he try and headbutt him once, he actually tried to headbutt him twice, which is why Joachim Andersen reacted in the way that he did. Darwin goes for him, misses, Andersen grabs him, and then does it again. You're like, my guy, there's cameras.
And this is basically inexplicable. He doesn't have a bad disciplinary record. I think he had one red card before this.
Yeah.
And didn't really have that many yellows. He's Uruguayan. Like, I'm sorry, but he's definitely played against gnarly centre-backs in the past. Yeah. I mean, he goes to national team training and turns up and plays against Jimenez and Godin.
Yeah.
Sure, like, this isn't a case of...
training, though. They're not trying to needle him.
I don't know, they might in the Uruguay squad.
There's going to be a bit of that. And, like, obviously, he's come up against some really, really good players in the past, you know, across Champions League campaigns and stuff like that. Like, he's played against proper centre-halves who would have engaged in this kind of behaviour before. Maybe it was the fact it was the home debut. He really wants to impress.
I think he was desperate to do well, isn't he?
He's so fired up and he's crossed the line. It's embarrassing. Now he's a target. Every single centre-back in the Premier League for the next 8 weeks will try and do this to him. He's got 3 weeks to basically figure out how to just keep the right side of the red line and just keep from the mist descending, because the next time he takes to the pitch, this will happen again and he needs to deal with it a lot better. But he doesn't have a particularly concerning past in this area, I wouldn't say.
Yeah, it's one of those. I think you can kind of write it off as that was a huge mistake, massive, and no one will be feeling it like he is, right? He'll be so upset. And he will know it. And Klopp isn't the kind of manager I don't think is going to go in and absolutely leather him for it either. He'll be like, right, okay, that wasn't okay, but, you know, we'll learn from it and we move on.
Yeah, well, he said he's not going to mention it.
In terms of, you know, what you were saying earlier, there were some big misses. I completely agree. But he was in some very good positions. And if he keeps getting in those positions, he's going to score a bucket load of goals.
No, he does get in good positions. Yeah, he's a bit of a chaos merchant too. And he's troublesome. I'm not denying that. And he'll probably end up being a really good player in this league. But it's the fiery nature of him at the moment. And I think it comes from the desire he's got. By the way, his first game back is the Merseyside derby, Everton away. Don't play him.
Yeah, stick him in. He'll be so desperate to prove
have him on a string.
Because if he gets villain of the week in that game, he's getting villain of the season already.
Even if he goes and scores 25 afterwards, he's and gets the golden boot, I think he's in trouble. It felt like this was going to be inevitable, and thus it proved. Darwin Nunez is melon of the week for the second time in this season, which is pretty stunning going, to be perfectly honest with you. Right. That is the gibberish diary, and I've decided to keep this short now because people have said it was better when I didn't do it for ages. So there you go. Don't say I don't listen to the people. That's exactly. Give the people what they want, as they say. Right, Sam, what have you got for us?
Yeah, this week's gibberish is my cat's three biggest enemies in life and the tactics that they're using to combat them.
Nice.
We're going to draw some parallels to football tactics as well. So I can see, obviously, they sit there and watch the football with me on TV and that. I can see they're picking things up from different managers. It's very obvious in their behaviour and the way that they're dealing with their enemies. Number three is the pigeons that live on next door's roof. I'd say about 50% of their day is spent watching and tracking these pigeons from the shadows or from a covered position. They will never, ever get anywhere near them, right? Like, ever. But they keep watch and they're very vigilant. And they basically exercise territorial dominance. And it appears to be effective. Like, the pigeons never, ever, ever land on our property, never in our garden, never on the balcony, nothing. And never on our roof either. I see Thomas Tuchel's tactics in play here. I think the cats have got full control of the situation. It's cagey. It's done from a distance, but it is effective. And I think they're managing the situation very well, which is something we always talk about with Thomas Tuchel's team. So plenty of Chelsea on my TV. And I think Hiro and Akira have been taking notes.
Okay. All right. I'm interested to see where this goes. I'm just going to let you roll on.
Yeah, I don't know how weird this is going to get.
Number two is the fully grown greyhound that walks in the park next to my house.
Okay.
Hiro, who's my male cat, has this thing absolutely rattled. Rattled. He's in his head nonstop. Hiro sits on the rail of the balcony and just stares at him for the entire time that this greyhound is out for a walk. And it goes mad. It goes mad, barking and barking and screeching and losing its mind and twirling in circles. And Hiro literally just sits there and looks at him the entire time. Doesn't move a muscle, just looks at him. He's perfectly safe. He's three stories up. There's no concern. And while we think it's really funny, the greyhound's owner is not that amused. Obviously, Hiro has done very little from our perspective. Some provocation, but nothing out of the ordinary. Pretty standard behavior, but nothing to warrant this kind of reaction. You know where I'm going with this, right?
He's Joachim Andersen.
Hiro is Joachim Andersen. This greyhound is Darwin Nunez on his Anfield debut.
Yes.
Just needs to... Yes. Just the red mist descends. And the number one in this list has to be any pet's greatest foe. It's the vacuum cleaner. This is the only battle, by my count, that my cats are losing. And they're not just losing it. They're being given the runaround, literally. They have no answer to this vacuum. It's aggressive. It covers so much ground. There really is no respite in the battle against the vacuum. It will corner you. It will make you feel very uncomfortable. I think the vacuum is essentially peak Jurgen Klopp pressing. And my cats are one of the many, many, many lower mid to mid-range Bundesliga teams that Jurgen Klopp put to the sword. They have no response to this kind of behaviour and these kind of tactics.
Do you taunt them with it?
I try not to.
The Gegenpress vacuum. This is a new one for us. This is new territory.
I really thought
you were going to go with like it's N'Golo Kante.
I was thinking Kante or Harrison Reed at one point, yeah.
Similar players, similar quality.
Yeah, very similar. But what we do see sometimes is if you leave the vacuum, rather than put it in the cupboard, if you just leave it in the corner of the room or whatever, you know, it's off, the coil is, you know, the cord is wound around it, it's completely off. Sometimes the cats walk past it and they sort of notice it in the corner and they know it's off and they walk over and they give it a whack. They give it a whack with their paw. They just kind of hit it a few times and then run off. It's as if they're like, well, you're off at the moment. You're not looking. I'm going to get you. And then you turn it on and they absolutely go mental and just run away. So they're sort of, it's almost like they think it's sleeping and it's their opportunity to get the better of it. It's really funny. But
they
obviously
do definitely think it's sleeping, Sam. This is animal instincts. they don't know what machinery is.
No, they don't. They really don't. But they're losing this battle every weekend. Okay. The house gets a clean and the cats are, they're hiding.
The cats are getting, brilliant, you know, pressed off the park. Fair play.
They really are, yeah.
They're in real trouble. They have no answer. It's a bit like Man United at Brentford, actually, at the weekend, right? Trying to play out the back and just getting pressed to death. Feels very similar.
De Gea's a lucky boy. There was a lot of melons this week and De Gea was up there, I can assure you. And Man United, everyone involved in those goal kick routines was involved in that too.
Yeah. It was a shame we didn't get the melon ranking, but sometimes you're just given gifts, DJ.
And
you have to accept them gratefully, I think, on the whole. Okie dokie, on that bombshell, I think we are going to call this a day. And all that's left for me to do is say thank you very much to Rank God, Mr. Sam Tai.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you very much to Toxic Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC. Thank you so much for listening as ever. We will, of course, be back next week. Enjoy all the football this weekend. Enjoy the European qualifiers for the Champions League and Europa League and Europa Conference League. There's lots of fun to be had. We'll see you next week, gang. Take it easy. Peace.